For the week of January 2nd, 2011, this is Showbiz Sandbox Episode 86, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news-making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
Where's Karen? I was waiting for Karen to say something.
Were you on last week's episode? Karen, actually, in case you're not keeping up with the podcasts, she is no longer a regular part of the show, which was her choice. She actually is having a budding social network. She's a social network manager, and her career has totally taken off, and she just doesn't have time for the likes of us anymore.
I thought she was joking. She's really gone?
Yes, unfortunately.
Well, then in New York, I'm Michael Gills.
Well, I'm sorry you're depressed. Maybe today's show can cheer you up, though. We'll be speaking with author and film critic Alonzo Duralde about some 2010 movies he believes were completely mismarketed. We'll also tell you about some of the films from past years, which were selected by the Library of Congress for the National Film Registry. Now, when it comes to television, we'll give you a rundown on how some of this season's shows have fared and how they've affected their cable networks. Then, during Inside Baseball, we'll take a look at what some of the trends music industry pros think we'll see in the coming year. Of course, we always cover all the big showbiz news during Big Deal or Big Whoop. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office. And I believe that some of these films really have some true legs.
That's absolutely true. The number one film of the week is Little Fockers, which just edged out True Grit with $26.3 million. It's at $103 million total. And yet it feels like sort of a flop because it's way behind the last film in this series. And it cost about $100 million to make. At number two is True Grit, the Coen brothers film, which grossed $24.5 million. It's at $86 million, but it's the biggest hit of the Coen brothers' career, and it's doing just tremendously well and has a lot of Oscar potential and box office looking ahead down the road. At number three is Tron Legacy, which grossed $18 million. That's at $130 million total in the U.S. It also grossed $110 million overseas, so that's $240 million, but it cost $170 million to make, a lot more to market, and it too feels like a middling success at best so far. At number four is Yogi Bear. That grossed $13 million for the weekend, $66 million so far. At number five, The Chronicles of Narnia, The Voyage of the Dawn Treader. That grossed $10 million, $87 million in the U.S., but $210 million overseas. So that's a movie that's really being saved by the rest of the world. And number six is Tangled, which grossed $10 million. This is the Disney animated film, the retelling of Rapunzel. It's at $168 million in the U.S., another $145 million overseas. So you're looking at over $300 million, the 20th Disney animated film to do so far. And that's a huge hit for them. And number seven is The Fighter, one of a couple very small films that's doing tremendously good business. The Fighter grossed $10 million for the weekend. It's at $46 million total. That's the Mark Wahlberg film about an Irish boxer. At number eight is the big flop Gulliver's Travels.
Wait, it's not about an Irish boxer. It's about he's Irish-American.
Irish-American.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, sorry. Thank you. And number eight is Gulliver's Travels, the Jack Black film, which grossed $9 million, $27 million total, a huge flop. And number nine is Black Swan, another Oscar hopeful. It grossed another $8 million. And right alongside The Fighter, it's grossed $47 million total. And at number 10 is The King's Speech, another big Oscar hopeful, which is just starting to platform wide. It grossed $7.6 million for the weekend. It has the highest per screen average. It's grossed $22 million total. And it's going to be making money for months to come. Did you see any movies this weekend, Sperling?
I saw a couple of movies over the past week at screenings and going to see the movies. I would say the two big ones that I saw were 127 Hours and The King's Speech. Those are the ones that people would probably care about.
How did they play and how did you like them?
127 Hours is a good movie. It's remarkable that Danny Boyle could make a movie about a guy who gets his arm pinned in by a boulder while hiking out in Utah, and most of the movie takes place with only one person, and yet it does work. If I did have a problem with it, it was more about the fact that Aaron Ralston, the subject of the film, which Aaron Ralston is a true person. I mean, this was based on a true story. You kind of have to go, God, this guy is so arrogant and so dumb that he would go out into the wilderness completely alone, not tell anybody where he's going. Then he gets his arm pinned and we're supposed to feel sorry for him.
But people do that every day. It's not like, I mean, it's not that he was so crazily unusual like everybody else. People go hiking and camping and boating all the time without telling people where they're going.
Right. And he does actually, through the course of the film, make this realization that he was kind of an idiot for doing that, that he should have at least let one or two people know, hey, I'm going to this Blue John Canyon, and that's where I'll be in case I don't come back. And so at least he kind of grew in that regard. And I think the film works because everybody can put themselves in Aaron Ralston's, and played by James Franco. So everybody can put themselves in James Franco's spot, where what would they do if their hand was pinned by a boulder? Would they amputate their own arm?
Was this an Oscar hopeful screening? Was this a screening where a lot of people who are going to vote on the Oscars saw it?
Well, just define a lot.
What's that mean?
Meaning it was a small screening. There weren't a lot of people there. But yes, it was.
No, I'm saying it was a screening for Oscar people.
Yes. And
so how did it play with them?
Very well. Mm-hmm. Very well. I think that they look at James Franco and they go, wow, he did a great job. And the film is, you know, really kind of a discussion piece afterwards.
What about The King's Speech?
That played incredibly well. That is a great film. And I'll tell you, right before we started recording the podcast, I felt like I should be gargling and having my throat sprayed.
That's a scene from the movie where we see a BBC radio announcer prepare to go on the air, and he has a whole ritual that he goes through.
Right, and this is the film about King George VI, who was the reluctant king. He had a stammer, a stutter, and Jeffrey Rush plays the speech therapist who comes in and helps him learn how to speak publicly at a time, the 1920s through 1940s, when he had to begin speaking on the radio and on, well, I guess just the radio. And as it leads up to World War II, it is a wonderful film.
Yeah, no, it's a real crowd pleaser. It's definitely going to be a major Oscar contender. And I'm sure the audience you saw it with loved it too.
Oh, absolutely. Colin Firth can just walk up on stage. When they start making their announcements, you know, as who's nominated, he should just walk right up onto the Oscar stage, pick up the statue and start giving the speech. Save us all of a lot of time.
Absolutely. Well, Tangled, of course, was a big hit. It's about to pass Tarzan to become the highest grossing Disney animated film since The Lion King. That does not include Pixar films, of course. That includes pure Disney films. And but as you point out, it's way behind in admissions so far.
Yes, it's estimated approximate 21 million admissions, 21.1 million admissions. Tarzan, back in, I think, 98, had 33.67 million admissions. And The Lion King had 78.59 million admissions. And that kind of tells you really the story of the year. You have a lot of these films that they're making money, but the way they're making money is through higher ticket prices.
Well, yes, The Lion King is one of the biggest hits of all time. I mean, comparing a box office its ticket sales to that is like comparing a movie to Avatar. It's always going to come up short.
Well, right. And I think a lot of times people are saying, oh, this movie's a bomb. It bombed in the United States. Well, yeah, it did bomb. Gulliver's Travels, I think we can all say, did not do well in the U.S. It made $47 million in just a handful of territories overseas. It made $10 million in the U.K. alone this past weekend.
Right, which is kind of amazing. But, you know, that's why we always say that you have to wait till the end and look at worldwide box office and DVD, and then you can decide what, you know, how much did it cost and how much did it make? That's all that really matters. You know, who gets opening weekend, who has a higher per screen average, who made more in 3D versus 2D? Nobody cares. You know, when it comes down to it, as far as a business, the hard numbers are all that matter, and you don't know them until it's played out throughout the world and on DVD.
Well, so far, speaking of hard numbers, Tron Legacy, considered to be a, you know, not a huge disappointment, but not a huge hit either. It's made $110 million overseas. Here in the United States, it's up around, $130 million?
Yeah.
And when it was at $100 million, 25% of its gross came from IMAX.
From just 200 plus screens out of 3,500 screens total.
Right, 235 screens. And, you know, those IMAX films, they cost a fortune.
Well, but to see. Oh, absolutely. It's ridiculous. I mean, it wasn't shot in IMAX, was it?
No, it was not.
So frankly, I think, honestly, you're an idiot if you pay to see a movie in IMAX that wasn't shot in IMAX, at least whole or in part. I mean, it's a hard movie-going experience. It's hard to get a good seat and get a good perspective on the film. It's hard to see everything, and it's just not worth the extra bang for the buck, I don't think.
Well, Avatar is the biggest grossing IMAX film, pulling in $128 million over 5 months.
Wow.
But, you know, Tron now has pulled in 25% of its $100 million.
I would love to know every week how much movies are making from their 3D, what percentage of their gross is from 3D sales and 2D sales. I'd love to know how much of Yogi Bear and Tangled and any movie that's in 3D. I'd love to have a breakdown every week because I think we're still seeing a big resistance to 3D movies.
Well, you know, I didn't look that up before we started, but in the future I'll try and get those numbers beforehand because they certainly do publish them. And yeah. It is something
where do you find them?
They're published by you know, whether it's a Rent Track usually or Box Office Mojo or the LA Times or the Hollywood Reporter, somebody will have them.
And of course, IMAX likes to be seen as a big source of income for movies because they're in a possible takeover battle right now.
Yeah, I mean, IMAX for a while, I mean, they were going to go bankrupt and they were really struggling financially. But then they started opening these kind of IMAX light theaters to show movies like Star Trek and Avatar and Tron. And they're not full IMAX screens. They're kind of retrofitted movie theaters.
Yeah.
They're just not the same experience, in my opinion. But they started opening these at a really...
a torrid pace.
Yeah, and they started doing it overseas as well. And this is their best year ever financially. And on Friday, their stock shot up with rumors that Sony and or Walt Disney may actually acquire them. There's some rumors that Sony might pay $40 per share.
And do you think that they've done do you think they're going to... the bloom will come off the rose? Or do you think that those... I think you were a little skeptical of that retrofitting and that sort of IMAX light. Or do you think it's paid off financially and it's going to be a good market for them? Or do you think that could come back to hurt them in the end?
You know, it's funny. Yeah, on Celluloid Junkie, I was a little skeptical about it as well. I think that, you know, I walked into a movie theater this week. It was the middle of the day on a weekday and had to pay $16 for a matinee because they had, quote unquote, holiday prices. And everybody was complaining. IMAX movies cost a lot of money to go to. They cost, you know, what, $19, $20, $25 in New York. And it's expensive. And so you're really only attracting those people with disposable income that don't have kids, that aren't families, because families aren't going to this. They're going to see either the 3D film or the 2D version.
And, of course, overall, with IMAX and increased ticket sales, ticket prices, of course, that helps the revenue. The revenue for the year, however, was down from last year.
Not a lot. I mean, certainly it was last year was $10.6 billion, was a record box office here in North America. And this year's North American box office was $10.556 billion. So it just barely missed reaching last year's gross.
Right. It was the highest gross of all time. So this year was perhaps the second highest grossing year in Hollywood history?
Probably, yes. and yet seen as an utter disappointment.
Not to me, of course, but ticket sales are down fairly significantly.
And that's why it's seen as a disappointment. Ticket sales fell 5.36%. And I think the reason it's really seen as a disappointment, this is my insider take, I guess, is the summer had the lowest attended summer movie season in over a decade. And the holiday season, attendance began to fall even more quickly. So,
well, year over year, we had Avatar.
Right. But they're down significantly. Trending-wise.
They're going to be down for the next 3 months.
Right, because of Avatar.
Yeah. And again, if you're the second highest grossing year of all time, that's not a disaster. Plus, they released only 517 major releases this year as opposed to a peak of 631 in 2007. So if you're releasing 120 fewer movies, you're probably spending less money and you're making basically the same amount at the box office. Guess what? Fewer movies to see, fewer ticket sales, and yet you're still grossing a ton of money.
Well, do you, I mean, certainly it falls in line with what the studios say, that they're cutting back, they're not going to be making as many movies, that they're going to be focused on these big blockbuster movies that they hope can, you know, be turned into franchises.
But I haven't seen any figures yet for the decade. Have you seen hard ticket sales or admissions and revenue for the decade yet?
Only for 2000 through 2009, not through 2010.
Yeah, so we need that final decade so we can compare the tens, the noughts, I guess, to the 90s and the 80s and the 70s. Because it has been a steady increase all the way. If we're leveling off a little bit, all right. But, you know, people always decry year-to-year box office declines, and yet we sell more tickets, gross more money, et cetera, every decade since the 70s.
So then you totally disagree with what Kati Chubb said on our show just last week.
Not about this decade, because he said that about this decade, but I haven't seen firm figures yet.
Okay, so, but
I don't know where he got his figures from.
And he was saying that ticket sales were flat throughout the decade and didn't increase, despite the fact that our population increased, that ticket sales did not increase, movie ticket sales.
Right.
Well, box office is down, as we've been talking about, and fewer people are going to the movies, as we've also discussed. And maybe a part of one reason, maybe because of marketing and how these movies are being marketed. And joining us now, Michael, is not just any author, but because we don't just have any author on our show, we have only authors that have written not one but two books, is author and film critic Alonzo Duralde. Alonzo, thank you for joining us. Your new book is Have Yourself a Movie Little Christmas. And if I had actually a calendar or something, we could have had you on, you know, before Christmas to plug the book.
That might have been nice, yes. But you can have me on this December. I'll still have plenty to say on the subject.
I would imagine. Now, you wrote a story for Movie Line about, well, not only the American, but six other mismarketed movies of 2010. Now, what was wrong with the way the American was marketed?
Well, you know, I guess I should be clear that I was saying mismarketed in terms of misleadingly marketed. I think it was sort of shrewd on the part of Focus to sell this movie that was very quiet, very austere, as a George Clooney action movie, which it very much was not. And so that basically got them one good opening weekend, but then a lot of very low ratings on CinemaScore and a lot of people who felt like they'd been burned.
So to clarify, this isn't a list of movies where they sort of necessarily botched it and left money on the table. This is a list of six movies where you felt they were especially misleading about the content and type of the movie, whether or not that worked to their advantage financially.
It kind of, yeah. I mean, I'd say one of them was mismarketed in the traditional, like, you guys screwed this up. But a lot of them were, I think, very sort of consciously, you know, bait and switch.
Well, which one did they screw up?
I would imagine that, wait, I'm going to see if I can guess the one, which is Morning Glory.
That's it.
Yeah.
Morning Glory was a much better movie than the trailers would lead you to believe.
I enjoyed that movie, and I would agree with you that it was, as you say, you know, surprisingly good, and the trailer was horrible.
Yeah, it made it just look like, it made it look a lot like other films that Aileen Brosh McKenna wrote, specifically 27 Dresses, where you just want to smack everyone on screen and you feel like it's a chick flick that hates chicks. But the actual film, I thought, was smarter and better than that.
Now, You Again was another film that you kind of pointed out that had the opposite problem of Morning Glory. The trailer looked funny and the Funny or Die clip was hilarious, but the movie wasn't.
Yeah, that was you know, and certainly, I mean, again, this is nothing new. You know, when you have a crappy comedy, I'm sure you pay the trailer guy a bonus to somehow glean the scant seconds that might appear to be hilarious out of context and you know, create a coming attractions that people would want to go see. But yeah, it was a dreadful movie, but the marketing materials would lead you to believe that they had something there.
Well, I know that one trailer that everybody seemed to think did not work initially was the trailer for Tangled. Everybody thought, what is this movie about? Because they only kind of put one scene in. But you say the whole film may have been mismarketed.
Well, I mean, again, it was a very conscious on the part of Disney that Princess and the Frog did not do the numbers that they had hoped. I mean, it wasn't a flop by any measure, but it certainly wasn't, you know, as big a success as they wanted it to be. And so I think they just decided from the top down, okay, girls will go see movies that boys want to see. Boys will not go see movies that girls want to see. So we're going to sell this movie to boys and, you know, girls will tag along. So this was a movie that went into production called Rapunzel. And then by the time it got to theaters, it was called Tangled.
And, of course, it did do very well at the box office, so that paid off for Disney in that sense.
Certainly.
But Catfish, that's a movie I'm wondering about, because that's a documentary. It's kind of a hard sell. It's a tricky little film to talk about. If you talk about it too much, you might spoil one of the big plot twists. So what did you think was the problem with that trailer and how they presented the movie?
Well, because the trailer sets, I mean, they literally, one of the big money quotes they splash on the screen is, you know, the thriller Hitchcock wishes he had made or something like that. And say what you will about Catfish. I wasn't a big fan of it, but it was no Hitchcockian thriller. I mean, and they really, watching the trailer after you've seen the movie, it's like when you see those trailers where they turn The Shining into a romantic comedy, you know, because they take a few moments and turn it into this like breathless handheld camera Blair Witch Project kind of thing, which the movie is very much not.
Mm-hmm. The one thing I disagree with is maybe Wall Street 2 Money Never Sleeps. Your objection to that trailer is that they play up Michael Douglas's character too much. I don't know. I think I feel like he is the dominant supporting character, and he certainly dominates the film emotionally in a way. You know, it's not like he has a cameo like Bruce Willis in The Expendables, and they blow it up to make him seem like he's part of the movie. He actually is in the film a fair amount.
No, it's true. He is. But you get the impression that he is the star of the film in a way. And really, when you see the movie, it's really more about the Shia LaBeouf character. And he's just kind of, and Gordon Gekko is sort of there, I felt, more as kind of a plot device to sort of throw some gotchas at the audience. So I don't know. I mean, a case could be made that that one was a little more honest, but I think that they sell you a lot of Michael Douglas and then give you more LaBeouf than you were expecting.
Where's the, what do you think are the best marketed films of the year? I felt like Inception was a really hard movie to market. Yeah, you know, you had the name brand, obviously, of the director, Christopher Nolan.
Yeah, that's a movie where you saw the trailer and you were like, oh my God, I want to see that right now.
And yet the trailer told you nothing about the movie.
Yeah, no. I mean, they were very shrewd about not showing it to a lot of people in advance, not really talking about what it was about. So by the time it came out, you almost put yourself in that place of, don't tell me anything I don't want to know. Like, I really want to walk into this as blankly as I can. Which is usually the sort of thing that you have to sort of generate with a movie like, say, you know, The Crying Game is the classic example of people saying, you have to go see this movie and I can't tell you why, you know, and that's the best kind of word of mouth you can generate. That's like The Sixth Sense did that sort of thing. And so with Inception, they managed to do that without anyone having even seen the film yet.
And what about looking ahead at 2011? There are a number of movies that are coming out that could be big challenges or not. I think the obvious one is Cowboys and Aliens, the summer film that they're already trying to make clear in people's mind what kind of movie it is, whether it's funny or serious or scary or, you know, action-y, that sort of thing.
Well, couldn't you just say it's a sci-fi Western?
That's what I would say. But are there any movies coming up that you're wondering how they're going to handle it? Like, is Thor an easy sell or is that hard because of the weird dialogue?
Well, you know, I mean, I think they very shrewdly hired Kenneth Branagh, who, you know, being such a Shakespeare guy, I think knows how to juggle that stuff and make it palatable to mainstream audiences. I mean, yeah, you're not going to dwell on the these and nows in the trailer, probably. The one that I'm finding a little quirky is Your Highness. I am a big fan of everybody involved, and I got to say that trailer doesn't make me laugh.
And what is Your Highness?
Your Highness is a sort of stoner comedy set in the Dark Ages.
Oh, right.
with James Franco and Natalie Portman and Danny McBride, and it's from the director of Observe and Report and The Foot Fist Way. It's clearly very R-rated. Like, there's a red band trailer. This is a movie that's clearly going to be sort of bawdy and naughty and, you know, lots of drug references and lots of, you know, profanity. And I'm down for all of that, but the trailer is not selling it to me. Like, I'm not laughing at this trailer. So I'm hoping that the movie is going to surprise me.
Well, what about movies like Moneyball? I mean, my feeling is if you can sell a movie about Facebook, then you can sell a movie about anything. But Michael was wondering, I see in the show notes here, he wrote down Moneyball might be one of the difficult challenges for 2011.
True. Well, I mean, you know, anything where it feels like you're teaching something or skirting close to documentary, I think they really get nervous about for a mass audience. So they have to really kind of give that some zing and sort of make it, you know, do what Inside Job did for, you know, the economic crisis, sort of make it, give it a very clean through line and make it, you know, accessible to people. Well, I'll tell you, the tricky movie to sell for me this year, I think, and it was supposed to be, it was a tricky movie to sell last year, and they put it on the shelf, and that might be why, is what's the Matt Damon movie with the, where everybody's wearing hats?
Something About Bourne.
No, the it's based on a Philip K. Dick, the Something Bureau.
Oh, the yeah, I know what you're talking about.
That one.
Yeah.
That was the trailer where I was like, what? And, you know, they have, like I said, they yanked it. It was supposed to come out this past fall, and now it's set for 2011. I think they're still trying to figure out how to sell the thing.
Well, the Smurfs kind of have built-in marketing power. I mean, I just figured, you know, if we can't remember the name of a Matt Damon movie, we should probably just move on to Blue Tiny Creatures.
Well, you know that they're nervous about the fact that the Yogi Bear underperformed.
Yogi Bear looked god awful. I think the challenge of the Smurfs is it a kids movie, adult movie? I don't feel like the franchise has a lot of staying power, particularly. I don't think the show is watched a lot by little kids. So are they going to try to make it cooler for everyone or just focus on kiddies?
Yeah, I don't know that kids know what it is. And I don't know that adults, I don't know how fondly they think back on it, frankly. I don't know how much Smurfs nostalgia there is.
I just liked Smurfette, frankly.
And of course you did. The Matt Damon film is called The Adjustment Bureau, and it's written and directed by George Nolfi, based on the Philip K. Dick short story.
The fact that I can't remember the title should tell you something about the marketing problems it's having.
Oh, I can't believe you guys didn't laugh at my Smurfette joke. But hey, listen, speaking of films people laughed at, Kick-Ass and Scott Pilgrim versus the World were two films that were released during 2010 that had lots of buzz going into their release and few dollars coming out of their release. Were those films handled properly marketing-wise?
I'm not sure what the formula is for that kind of thing, because those are the kind of movies where you can fill up Hall H at Comic-Con, you know, at the drop of a hat, but then actually getting people into theaters always seems to be a challenge. It's it's the snakes on a plane syndrome, where there's a lot of internet buzz among people who create internet buzz, but not necessarily among, like, you know, Joe audience. But I liked both of those films, and I think they could have found their way, you know, into the hearts of more people. There's something about nerd culture that, you know, while it does hugely among nerds, it doesn't necessarily translate to the public at large. I mean, I, for one, was put off by Scott Pilgrim initially because I'm not a video game person. And I thought I wasn't going to understand what it was about or where it was going or, you know, visual cues or that kind of thing. But I actually, once I saw it, I found that it was very accommodating to a Luddite like me. So, you know, maybe that's the sort of thing where people just, they think that they have to know more about comics or video games to get these movies, and they don't, and that fact isn't being sold to them well enough.
Well, finally, how do you think that Hollywood can help market movies in the future? I mean, are they doing a good job? Are these just six or seven anomalies? Or do they really need to take a long, hard look at how they market movies in an age with Facebook and Twitter and whatever the next huge social networking tool might be?
Well, I mean, I'd say they've certainly hopped on the bandwagon when it comes to that kind of stuff. And they're very savvy about the fact that, you know, if a movie, people hate it on a Friday, they're going to tweet about it. You know, I always go back to, there's a great Pauline Kael quote where she says that marketing guys in Hollywood have sort of got themselves into a nice position, because if a movie underperforms, they can say, oh, well, the film just didn't have it. And then if it does well, they can say, boy, did we sell it? You know, so they sort of can't lose either way, unfortunately. You know, I think as with anything, we're going to find that they're going to have to come up with new ways to sort of dupe us, I think. You know, there was a piece in the LA Times today about why, The Tourist and How Do You Know and Gulliver's Travels all underperformed when
bad.
Yeah, well, exactly. That's the suck factor doesn't ever quite enter into it, because, you know, you throw that at Hollywood studios, they just blink and they don't know what you're talking about. But they said that people sort of saw through the marketing of The Tourist, and that it just looked too much like a million other movies they'd seen before, and that's why people didn't go.
Well, now you have two books, the first being 101 Must-See Movies for Gay Men. Now your new book, Have Yourself a Movie Little Christmas. Are you thinking maybe you'll do a third book on movie marketing, The Suck Factor, maybe? You'd throw that title out there and see if...
I don't think I could spend that much mental energy contemplating Hollywood marketing without wanting to, like, you know, go into a monastery. So I'm going to definitely say no, I will not. But it is something that I find interesting, and I'll certainly be keeping tabs on trailers that fooled me this year.
Well, certainly, until your next book is released, we can keep up with you not only on Twitter, but on MSNBC and Movie Line and HitFix and a number of outlets. We'll place links to all of them in the show notes. And Alonzo, thank you very much for joining us.
Always a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Thanks to you soon.
Take care, y'all.
Well, it was good of Alonzo Duraldi to take the time to talk with us about movies that were misleadingly marketed this year. I've worked with him at The Advocate magazine and more recently on an AOL blog. So it's always a good time, always a good chance to catch up with him.
Yeah, he's always a lot of fun to talk to. Now, do you think, Michael, that any of the movies that we talked about, whether it's, I don't know, I mean, Scott Pilgrim or The Smurfs, which may be a future entry here, Tangled possibly, or, I don't know, Catfish or Morning Glory, any of these films, do you think any of them, whether mismarketed or not, might, within the next, 10 or 15 years from now, be selected by the Library of Congress to be included in their National Film Registry?
Well, it's a long shot, but we do have the list of films that did make it this year.
Well, 25 films were deemed to be culturally, historically, or aesthetically significant this year by the Library of Congress. They picked 25 of these films for the National Film Registry, including Airplane, which is the Zucker Brothers' 1980 spoof of disaster movies, All the President's Men, which won the Oscar. It's a fact-based drama about the uncovering of the Watergate scandal, and I think all scandal-based movies are then kind of held up to All the President's Men. Let There Be Light was a John Huston documentary from 1946 that was banned for several decades. And then you have George Lucas's student film, THX-11384EB, which he then later turned into his first feature.
Which is the biggest argument I have on the list. One of two. I haven't even seen the student film, but it led to a poor feature. I don't know why. Star Wars certainly deserves to be enshrined, and The Empire Strikes Back was included this year. But why this student film? I don't see how it's even remotely culturally significant.
I couldn't tell you. I do know that, as you mentioned, The Empire Strikes Back was included, as was The Exorcist, and Lonesome, which was a 1928 part sound, part silent romance that was recently restored by the George Eastman House. Malcolm X, the Spike Lee film about the civil rights leader. And then from 1891, Nork Athlete, an experimental film by William K.L. Dickinson and William Heiss. And it was one of the first films made in America at the Edison Laboratory in West Orange, New Jersey. I kind of find that very interesting. But then there were comedies like The Pink Panther starring, Peter Sellers and Blake Edwards, who recently passed away, directed it. And Saturday Night Fever.
Well, again, this is not a list of the 25 best films or 25 films that they're enshrining as classics necessarily. They're culturally significant and important landmark films. So Saturday Night Fever, which is such an iconic movie, you can see why they would argue it belongs there. I'd say Grease is a much better film and deserves to be enshrined ahead of Saturday Night Fever, which I don't think really stands the test of time. But as far as the soundtrack and the white suit and the movie as it's spawning the craze for disco or actually capturing the craze for disco on film, you can see why it's there. The Blake Edwards film is a big bizarre choice as well. The Pink Panther is the first film about Inspector Clouseau. But I don't know any critic who doesn't think that A Shot in the Dark, the second film that they worked on, is infinitely superior in style and comedy and every possible level. I mean, they really got it right with A Shot in the Dark. That is the one that, really kicked the series into high gear and is so much better critically and commercially in every which way, that to enshrine the Pink Panther is just bizarre. It's like, no, The Shot in the Dark is where if you're going to do one Pink Panther film, it would be A Shot in the Dark. So that's just sort of a lazy, bizarre choice on their part.
This is a list of films that since 1988, I guess they have some 500 films now that they've included. It's picked by film guilds and archivists and really historians.
Right. And if you're going to historically pick a film from the Pink Panther series, it should be A Shot in the Dark. It's like a James Bond. You don't go with the first James Bond film. If you're going to pick one iconic one, it's Goldfinger, because that's where they got the formula. That's where everything clicked into place. And that's sort of the iconic film for that series. It's not Dr. No, which doesn't feel even as much like a James Bond film as the rest. And if you're going to historically pick one Pink Panther film, it should be A Shot in the Dark. Certainly not the Pink Panther.
Why didn't they include Inception?
Well, they wait. I believe they have a period of years that they wait before they start to include them. They don't include movies. They have to wait like a certain number of years, like 10 years.
I was throwing you a softball there.
I didn't know actually what the actual standard was, but at least a decade. And obviously, you want to wait longer if you're going to sort of enshrine them in history. Anyway, it's a great list. It's well worth checking out. I'm especially pleased about Make Way for Tomorrow, which is this heartbreaking film from 1937 that I only became aware of a year or two ago. It's directed by Leo McCarey, and it's just a, rent it on DVD, you'll weep like a baby. It's a really, really lovely film about two elderly people who come onto hard times and have to separate and each go to one of their different children to find a place to live. But there's a lot of good movies here, so check out the full list when you can.
Well, speaking of weeping like a baby, and that was my hard transition into television news, it looks like television viewing continues to edge up, but the audience continues to be fractured. So it's not just on NBC, ABC, and CBS, at least here in the United States.
Well, that's the story of the world. I mean, there's hundreds of cable channels now, thousands, really. You get onto my high definition channels are in the 1700s on my network system. So there's so many more options. You're never going to see shows dominate like they used to with 30, 40, 50 million viewers. There are obviously still shows on the major networks, and that's where the biggest eyeballs are. The number one news show on CBS was Hawaii Five-0.
That was the number one show of really this new season. So the number one show is actually 40 years old.
New show.
Yeah, number one new show is 40 years old. What does that tell you? It's like we're retreading everything in the movies, in television.
Been done since time began.
You know, why don't we just do Shakespeare?
And one channel that benefited especially was MTV. If you look online, you see, oh my God, MTV gets their biggest ratings gain in a decade. And you think, wow, MTV must be in gangbusters. But if you drill deeper, as they love to say in the industry, and look closer, you see that MTV is actually ranked about number 10 or 11 on the list of basic cable channels among adults 18 to 49. They actually only have two shows in the top 20. One, of course, is Jersey Shore, and the other one is Teen Mom, or whatever that's called.
Speaking of the top 20, I mean, so Nielsen is saying that people are watching in the U.S. and North America 34 hours of television per person per week.
Wow.
I can tell you that that's not true in my household.
I know. I watch way more than 34 hours.
Really?
I watch a ton.
Well, they also mentioned that the shift from broadcast to cable is occurring. But, how many of the shows in the top 10 were football games? 8 of the 10 highest rated telecasts of the year were football games. The two others were the Academy Awards and the premiere of Undercover Boss, which followed the Super Bowl.
Yeah, football on NBC on Sunday night has proven a real ratings bonanza. It's their only good news that they have. But sports will always draw people, especially young men who are harder to nail down and get them in front of a TV set. So that's why sports is so expensive and profitable for, the people to put on.
Well, and you said that MTV was having a good year. CNN, on the other hand, the cable news network, is having a horrible year. It was their worst ratings year since 1996.
But that will turn around with Piers Morgan taking over for Larry King.
Do you really think so?
No. Okay, no, I was joking. Again, MTV, I didn't say was having a great year. I said a relatively good year. Their success is exaggerated because they fell down so far. They've got about 633,000 viewers in prime time, I think, among 18 to 49-year-olds.
Except for Jersey Shore and Teen Mom, were they?
No, that's their average. Yeah. And that's their average in prime time among 18 to 49-year-olds. And they're only ranked number 10, so it's not like they're the biggest cable channel around. They're just not sucking so much.
Right. Well, and their music awards show, the MTV Video Music Awards, had 11.4 million viewers. That's a lot. And their website gets 57 million unique visitors per month.
So, no.
Yeah.
No. They get 57 million unique visitors a month? No, they don't.
Yes, indeed.
That's a misreading. What is that? Maybe 5.7. No, that's not true.
Go talk to Nielsen.
If they had 57 million unique visitors, they'd be bigger than the New York Times website. New York Times doesn't get 57 million visitors a month. There's no way. Maybe they get 57 million visits, meaning if I go 1,000 times in a month, I get 1,000. There's no way. They're not bigger than the New York Times and Huffington Post combined.
We will
There's
find
no
out
way.
and get back to you next week. But
all right. You promise?
I promise I will look this up. I will research it.
So we have a list of the top 20 basic cable shows, shows on basic cable, not HBO and not the major networks. How many of them have you ever seen or watched regularly?
Okay, shows. USA Network and ESPN and TBS were 1, 2, and 3. Rizzoli and Isles, wow, I've never seen that. The Closer, never seen. Royal Pains, number 3, never seen that. Covert.
You know what do you know what they are?
Yeah, they're...
Okay.
They're, yes, I do. Burn Notice, The Walking Dead in number 5. I have seen that. Burn Notice, I've seen a couple of episodes of Burn Notice with 6.59 million people watching every episode. Jersey Shore. Okay, last night I watched Jersey Shore, which is the 7th list here of primetime original basic cable series total viewers. I watched it just because I wanted to see what all the hype was about. It is the most asinine, inane show I've ever seen. I can't believe people watch this in droves. I mean, look at that. 5.9, nearly 6 million people watch that show every week.
Did you laugh?
You know what? Not really. No. I mean, I laugh at them, not with them.
Well, that's enough.
and you know what? Frankly, then I don't know what I'm complaining about. Number 8, Pawn Stars on the History Channel. 5.5 million people. This is a show about people who are pawnbrokers.
So are there any, other than The Walking Dead, is there any show that you watch regularly?
I watch Psych, which came in number 14.
Mm-hmm.
I don't watch Keeping Up with the Kardashians, which came in 17. I don't watch – apparently I'm incredibly unpopular because I don't watch any of these shows.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to catch up with Sons of Anarchy, which is at number 20. That's on the FX channel, and that's a growing hit, and it's got a lot of critical acclaim. But I have watched Royal Pains and The Closer and Rizzoli and Isles. I've sampled them. But the ones I watch regularly are simply The Walking Dead, and I think that's it. I've looked at Psych. And I've sampled almost all of these, but I have not watched Jersey Shore. But I'll tell you, there's so many channels out there. There's so many shows. They need to fill up. I was at my brother-in-law's for the end of the holidays, and I knew it was time to leave when they were changing the channels, and suddenly we started watching some reality show called When Vacations Attack. It was basically about disasters happening on vacation that people caught on film. So we're watching people almost fall out of a ski lift. We're watching a boat blow up just because, I mean, it was just the most idiotic waste of time. And I said, okay, now it's time for me to go.
How do you, we were talking to Alonzo Duralde earlier about marketing movies. How do you market television shows? I mean, there's so many of them these days.
Well, it's hard to break through the clutter, but, you know, you put ads on shows that are similar to them, or your channel creates a certain identity, like MTV with reality, or AMC with a, you know, sort of brash original series. You get Mad Men, and that leads you hopefully to something like The Walking Dead, and that hopefully leads you to something else.
Yeah, I think it's funny that we're talking about, you know, the reality shows on the music television channel.
Well, yeah, they're not anymore. That's long gone.
Yeah, but so you're saying that's not a big deal that they don't show music anymore?
Nope.
Is it a big whoop?
I got it. It's a segue.
Yeah, but I'm just so used to Karen being there to say, oh, no. Segue alerts, that I can then say that, yes, this was a segue into Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top entertainment news stories and whether they are a big deal or if anyone should care about them. Our first story this week is about video games. Hey, kids, play Nintendo's new handheld 3D game system, 3DS. Just don't look at it. That's the word from Nintendo. It's delayed, but highly anticipated 3D portable gaming system due out in Japan in February should not be used by kids 6 and under, says the toy maker. Imagine the taunting and teasing opportunity this gives to big brothers everywhere. Michael, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, it's a big whoop. I think they've had these caveats for a while now in video games and TVs and all this stuff for people using 3D. They don't. It seems to be just sort of a preemptive strike rather than based on any hard medical science, but that's what they keep saying. So there's nothing unusual or new about this 3DS game system.
Yeah, and there's actually no medical evidence that children under 6 should not view 3D content. Now, this is a 3D gaming system without glasses, so it's auto-stereoscopic. And, you know, there are some people who, some kind of reports out there that say, oh, you know, if people under the age of 6 look at 3D movies, it will hurt their eyes, it'll cross their eyes. That's not necessarily true at all.
Well, and they especially talk about kids under 3 when their vision is still developing. But guess what? Kids under 3 probably shouldn't be playing any video games whatsoever.
That's true.
Guess what? I know they play with your iPhone, but, you know, give them a book. Give them a block.
What's a book?
I don't know.
Okay, are those the things on my Kindle?
Yes.
Okay. If you change your mind, I'm the first in line.
Jans, take a chance. Sorry.
That's right. That's a lyric from ABBA's classic, Take a Chance on Me. Is there a chance that fans worldwide might actually have a chance to get in line for ABBA tickets? The two female members both said in recent interviews that a reunion concert would be fun for charity or something as opposed to a massive tour. They don't want to do that. Worldwide, ABBA remains one of the biggest-selling acts of all time, alongside the Beatles, the Rolling Stones, Queen, Led Zeppelin, and the like. Michael, is a possible ABBA reunion concert a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, it's a big whoop because there's no really news here. If you look at their actual quotes, it's like, sure, you know, I could see that happening. There's no actual plans or desire or need for all four of them to come back together. And it would be awesome. But in fact, I think we mentioned it like a year or so ago that they were offered like $1 billion to tour and do like a 30 or 40 city tour, $1 billion. And they turned that down. So, you know, they didn't come together for Live Aid. That was probably too soon after they broke up. But maybe some charity event in 10 or 20 years might bring them together. It would be awesome. I mean, why not go on a tour? They can't be that busy. I think it's a shame. It would be such a blast to see them together. And if they could do it for charity and make themselves feel good, all the better.
Spider-Man, Turn Off the Dark, takes another blow. Lead actress Natalie Mendoza, who plays the villain Arachne?
I don't know.
Well, she's leaving the show. Mendoza was injured during the very first preview, tried to return to work too soon, and then took weeks to get back into the show. Then she watched her good friend plummet 20 feet and go into the hospital, and apparently Mendoza never felt comfortable or safe again. Michael, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, unlike all the other delays and problems, I actually think this is a big deal because she's basically the villainess in the piece, and she dominates the second half of the show. She's been working with Julie Taymor to develop this character. It was sort of the driving reason Taymor had for creating the show. So losing her feels like a big deal. Obviously, her understudy could be great. She's been doing it for a while now. It just feels like a cursed show when you start to lose lead actors, you know, the guy doubling for Spider-Man, the major villain. That feels like a real artistic problem.
Did decency prevail? The Discovery Channel had scheduled a primetime special in Europe on January 13th. Michael Jackson's autopsy. What really killed Michael Jackson? This documentary was going to recreate, in quotes of course, MJ's autopsy and talk about the medical facts that were found. A wave of angry emails from fans and the Michael Jackson estate prompted Discovery to pull the plug on the special. Michael, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, I'd love to think that they found decency and it's a big deal, but I think it's a big whoop. And I imagine one of the letters from the estate was a legal letter of some sort. Otherwise, I can't imagine why they pulled the plug.
Don't be scared, but the master of horror, Stephen King, is retiring. His Entertainment Weekly column. After 7 years, the perennially best-selling author weighed in on movies, TV shows, books, music, you name it. Michael, big deal or big whoop?
I think it's a sort of a big deal. I mean, having a major author like this doing a weekly column in Entertainment Weekly was sort of crazy and unusual. You don't see that very much anywhere. I can't think of any other best-selling author who's been active in that way. And he had fun, crazy, quirky taste and championed things. I'm sure he's been a big fan of The Walking Dead. He's been a sort of an oddball, neato little weird presence on EW, and it's sorry to see him go.
Simon Baker, the star of one of CBS's biggest hits, The Mentalist, has signed on for another season for a cool $30 million. That's $1.5 million per episode, which adds up pretty quickly. Michael, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
I think it's a big deal that it's only for 1 year. I'm not sure why they just extended his contract for 1 year. Maybe that was all he'd agree to, but they're going to want him on there as long as they can keep him because he's definitely, you know, after two or three shows and a bunch of movies, he's a genuine TV star now and he's very appealing.
The Writers Guild of America naturally wants its writers to get as much money as possible. And if you're not doing a WGA-approved film, of course you can't win a WGA award. This year, that means movies such as The Following are ineligible. The King's Speech, Winner's Bone, Beautiful, Blue Valentine, Toy Story 3, and more. Will this hurt their Oscar chances? And is it a big deal or a big whoop that these films have been excluded, Michael?
It's a big whoop. You always have this sort of disconnect between the WG Awards and the Oscars and the other people who give out awards. I thought Toy Story 3 just didn't make their list. I didn't realize it wasn't eligible. Are Pixar animated films not eligible?
Oh, it didn't make the list. Sorry.
But that's not the same as saying it was ineligible.
Right.
Right. But so not being eligible to get on the list and not making the list can both affect your Oscar chances. Toy Story 3 really seems like a bizarre one since it was eligible and was a lovely script. But these other ones, you'll forget about it in a few weeks once the Oscar nominations come out.
Now, speaking of the Oscars, when screenwriter Chris Sparling asked you to vote for his screenplay for the Ryan Reynolds film Buried, which took place all in a coffin, he actually meant to say, nothing, actually. Turns out, asking people to vote for you is a no-no, and Sparling has apologized. And I should say, it turns out that asking people to vote for you for an Oscar is a no-no. If you are a politician, you're allowed to do it. So will that hurt his Oscar chances? Michael, big deal or big whoop?
It's a big whoop. It won't affect his Oscar chances in the least.
In fact, meaning he doesn't have any.
That's right.
Yeah, I mean, just so for those people who don't know, you're not allowed to write letters directly to Academy members saying, please vote for my film, or please vote for my screenplay, or please vote for my performance. What you can do is hand them a film, or invite them to see a film, or send them a screenplay that they can read. You can't directly solicit votes. On Thursday night, rapper-singer Provocateur, MIA, released a new WikiLeaks-inspired mixtape called WikiLeaks, a 36-minute rhythm frenzy featuring new production work by Diplo, Switch, and Blackstar, and a host of rhymes and rants by the artist born Maya. Please don't make me pronounce that.
Arul Pragasam.
Yeah. Big deal or big whoop?
Big whoop. Kind of funny, though.
Did you have you listened to the Gorillaz album, which was released on Christmas?
No, I was traveling, and you know, I don't download stuff onto my laptop. I put onto a separate hard drive, and I completely forgot about it. Is it still available to download? Can you still do that?
Oh, yeah, and it's pretty good. I don't think it was all done on an iPad, though.
Why are you calling him a liar?
Well, I'm not calling him a liar. I'm just saying.
You're calling him a liar. He said he did it all on his iPad.
I'm gonna research that too. I've got a lot of homework from this episode.
You sure do. Well, I have to say, Gorillaz Plastic Beach is one of my favorite albums of the year, and I'll be coming up with my album of the year list within the next week or two.
And where will you be posting it?
I'll post it on Huffington Post.
Huffington Post. Okay.
Yeah,
well,
along with my best movies of the year and all that stuff. I got a few things I got to see and listen to still.
You do realize that the year is over, right?
I always do my stuff in January. You know, I'm not a film critic for new releases, so I don't get the chances to see a lot of I see some new movies in advance, but a lot of movies I don't get a chance to see in advance. I got to catch up with them when they come out, or I want to watch them again. I might have seen them at a festival or at a screening, like Blue Valentine, I really want to see again. Inception, I'm going to watch again on DVD. So I see hundreds of movies, and I just feel obliged to, you know, do the work and catch up. So it's always January, sometimes February, before I do a movies and CD list.
Well, that brings us to Inside Baseball, our weekly segment where we discuss only the news stories people in Hollywood might care about. And of course, Michael, as we were just talking about, you're making lists, and lots of critics make lists at the end of the years. Lots of columnists and journalists make lists at the end of the years about things that happened in the previous year. Some lists are actually created by numbers. And Bon Jovi made the list this year for the highest grossing concert. He may not have made it into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, at least on the first go-round, but topping the concert charts, he drew in $200 million in sales, or I should say the band drew in $200 million in sales. In the U.S., they were second behind only the Dave Matthews Band in actual ticket sales, an even better barometer of popularity.
That's right. So worldwide, in box office gross, Bon Jovi was number one, AC/DC was number two, U2 was number three, then Lady Gaga and Metallica.
What's interesting is that U2 had to take several months off, like 5 or 6 months off, because their lead singer Bono had back surgery, and yet they still wind up number three.
Yeah, well, they put in the sales, so they put in the tour. They made up all their dates, and they're a huge draw, even despite the fact that their last album was not a big seller commercially.
Well, here's the thing. Ticket sales, concert ticket sales, are down. Why? A lot of people in the music industry speculate it's because concert ticket prices are way too high, and that what we should expect over the next couple of years is for ticket prices to slowly start coming down.
And they did come down in the U.S. They still rose worldwide, but in the U.S. there actually was a slight blip downwards in tickets, the cost of tickets that people pay and when they go to a concert. And in ticket sales, the number one act was Dave Matthews, followed by Bon Jovi, and then Justin Bieber, John Mayer, and Brad Paisley. So they wouldn't be the top five in grosses, but they were the top five in the number of people who said, I want to see that act, and they forked over their $30 or $40 or $50 or $80 to go see him.
I read this statistic that in 1966, it would have cost $5 and change to see the Beatles play at Shea Stadium.
Mm-hmm.
It was 66, 65, somewhere in there. And if adjusted for inflation, that would be around $37.
Which seems like a pretty fair, a good amount, yeah.
Well, yeah, except the Rolling Stones and like bands charge $300.
That's right, for their top ticket, well, one of their top tickets. Yeah, no, it's just a huge problem. I mean, you have concert revenue down, and ticket prices have been exploding for years. They're finally starting to level off at the concert tour. Movie ticket prices continue to go up, not even mentioning the fact that they charge you a premium for 3D. You know, you've seen ticket prices rise up everywhere. People pay $130 a month for their cable bill. The only area where you see ticket prices coming down steadily is in books, where ebooks tend to be dramatically lower in a lot of cases than new releases in hardcover. And of course, that's the one thing the publishing industry hates, and they want to end that as soon as possible.
You know, speaking of trends, Hypebot, a website that I like to read, it's a music and new media website. They asked industry professionals, music industry professionals, what do you see as the most important business and consumer trends that will shape the music industry in 2011? And they asked this of a number of people, and we have some of them here listed out in our show notes. And the first one was Bruce Warilla, the co-founder of Music Think Tank, another great blog, by the way, and VP of Product for Emergent Discovery. He believes that sometime in 2011, we should see the Add Music button adjacent to songs and videos on sites around the web. The Add Music button will enable music fans to collect or bookmark songs for subsequent streaming to any connected and capable device. That would actually be quite good.
Yeah, I mean, you have that on YouTube now. That's how they made that deal to keep commercial music in people's own little videos and stuff. You go to YouTube, if you watch somebody's home video and they use an actual song in it, you see a buy this song now click button. And I can see that spreading everywhere. I'm surprised it hasn't happened yet.
Well, you'll be happy about this. Brian Hazard of Color Theory and Passive Promotion, he says that one trend we'll see is the U.S. launch of Spotify and competing services from Apple and Google, which will catalyze the inevitable shift from music ownership to music rental.
Well, I mentioned this at Christmas. I was at my sister's, and she subscribes to music streaming. She pays $11 a month for, I forget which service it is, but there she was. She said, here, play some Christmas music. And I just started typing in names and made up a playlist of like 30 songs in about, 5 minutes. None of the music does she own, but it started streaming from her iPad to her home stereo system and playing out all over the house. And I started thinking what albums are available. And wow, when you find how many albums are available on these services, it's hard to think why anybody would buy an album ever again.
Well, George Howard, a music industry educator and leading blogger, says what he hopes we'll see is a greater degree of transparency and clarity with respect to licensing fees for streaming, not for broadcast and not for on television and in movies, but interactive, non-interactive, mobile, etc. And he says, really, only when that occurs will we get true innovation. And I would have to agree, it is a pain in the neck to license music for the web.
So what is he talking about? He's talking about making it easier for someone like you to license music?
Someone like Spotify or someone like more business-oriented. You know, maybe mm-hmm. somebody like me, if we're producing a podcast and need, intro music, but not for the music listener. You know, business-wise, if you're Pandora or somebody like that, that's what he's referring to. Ian Rogers actually made a lot of news this year with Topspin Media. He's the CEO of that company. He says that we all know 5 years from now, we won't be connecting our iPods and transferring downloads over a little wire. Those bits will come on demand and from the cloud. But if that's the case, what services are those coming from? Will Spotify make it to the US? Will Google Music launch? And will it be great? Will it be for more than just Android? And he goes on about, what are these new services that will help bring music to the mobile masses?
So just like Brian Hazard, he sees streaming as being the inevitable future for music.
Yes.
Well, all right. Maybe something will make people decry the music industry, and they've really been hit hard by the digital changes that swept through them. But I tell you, there's so much great music out there. It's so much easier to hear it than ever before. I think if you're a music fan, you should be really happy. It's hard to get a good filter to find out what to listen to, but there's a lot of great music out there.
I would agree. And that kind of concludes our show this week, although we do have some listener email. We got a flood of emails about Karen's departure, and I know, Michael, you have one you want to read.
Yes, I do. I got this from Zoe in London. She said, just listen to the first 10 minutes of the podcast. How can Karen leave? I'm gutted. And we feel much the same way.
And indeed, a lot of the emails were quite similar to that. And so thank you for them. If you want to email us, you can. The email address is dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. Or you can call us and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. Of course, you can find all of that information as well as ways to donate to us and ways to connect with us using some of these social media tools like Twitter and Facebook. That's all on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's also where you'll find the show notes for this episode and all of our past episodes. The show notes have all of the links to the stories we've discussed in today's episode. Now, the music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show, that's by MGMT, the popular indie rock group. So there's some of that good music Michael was talking about. They can be found on whoismgmt.com. Michael Giltz can be found in Brooklyn, New York, as he said at the head of the show, but also online. His website is michaelgiltz.com, and he's on Twitter. @MichaelGiltz is the username to look up. I'd like to thank Alonzo Duralde for joining us. We'll place links to all of his work in the show notes. I'm on Twitter @Sperling is the username to look up. You can also read some of my writing @Celluloid Junkie. Until next week, play nice.